offered Jesse the last bite of meatloaf, which she declined, but he said, "Come on," and popped it into Jesse's mouth, and his fingers touched her lips in a way that made her feel faint. She drank some of her ginger ale. It was cold and spicy, and wondered if she should leave, but Pick cleared away the box, then turned around so that his back was to the railing, and he was facing Jesse. He stretched out his dungareed legs, one of which was grazing Jesse's bare knee. He might not have noticed it, but Jesse was 100% nerve endings, all of them alert and yearning. It was funny the way being touched by Garrison had been offensive and gross, but the slightest contact with Pick made her feel like she had eaten magic beans. "So, Jesse," Pick said, "how are things?"
"My father got here last night," Jesse said. "He's a lawyer in Boston and only comes on weekends. I thought he would bring a letter from my brother, Tiger, but he didn't."
"Tiger is in Vietnam," Pick said, as if Jesse didn't know.
"I miss him," she said.
"He's your half-brother, right?" Pick said. "And you have two half-sisters?"
"Blair and Kirby," Jesse said.
She bristled at the fact that Mr. Crimmins seemed to have shared even more family particulars. If they weren't allowed to use the qualifiers half and step, why should Pick be able to? She decided to turn the tables on him.
"Do you miss your mother?"
she asked. Pick blew out a stream of air but said nothing, and Jesse felt like a complete heel for asking.
"There's stuff I didn't tell you," Pick said.
He leaned forward.
"She left for a reason. There was a man at the commune named Zeppelin, and he and my mother were together, but he used to hurt her, so she ran away."
Jesse thought of how badly she had wanted to get away from Garrison.
"Did she tell you she was going?"
"No," Pick said. "But when I woke up and found out she had left, I knew that was why. It had nothing to do with me."
Jesse wondered if this story was true, or if Pick had invented it to make himself feel better.
Pick said, "I was afraid Zepp might come after me when my mom left, but he took up immediately with a woman named Bunny."
"Oh," Jesse said.
"Things were kind of like that at the commune," Pick said. "Sharing, partner swaps, no traditional relationship roles. My mom knew it was okay to leave me because there were plenty of other people to care for me."
Pick stood up and peered over the railing like Plum Lane was a pool that he was about to dive into. Jesse stood as well. She should get back to the main house. It wasn't impossible that Kate, in her melancholy state, would want to put her eyes on Jesse, the only child remaining at home. If she found Jesse's bed empty, who knew what she might do?
"I know where to find my mother," Pick said.
"You do?" Jesse said.
"There's going to be a big concert in August," Pick said, "in a town called Woodstock, New York. Jimi Hendrix is playing, and Creedence, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, The Who, Joe Cocker, Joan Baez, The Band, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young."
"The Beatles?"
Jesse asked hopefully. She had heard of most of the people Pick just mentioned, but they weren't her favorites.
"What about Joni Mitchell?"
Jesse thought about what it would be like to hear Joni Mitchell singing Both Sides Now in person. Jesse had yet to even play her record on the Magnavox.
"The point is, everyone is going to be there," Pick said. "And my mother? Well, she wouldn't miss it. I know that much."
"So you're going?"
Jesse asked.
"You're going to Woodstock, New York?"
"In August," Pick said. "I'm saving my paychecks. I figure I'll hop on the ferry a couple days before, take the bus to Boston, and hitchhike from there."
"And then how will you get back?"
Jesse asked. She supposed what she was really asking was if he was coming back at all. Pick shrugged.
"My mom and I will figure it out. There are going to be thousands of people there. I'm sure someone can give us a ride. My mom is good at making friends."
Pick turned to Jesse, and a smile lit up his face.
"Why don't you come with me?"
Jesse opened her mouth to laugh at the absurdity of the offer, or maybe to lament that she was still too young to leave the island alone. But instead of doing either, she said,
Okay.
Okay, you'll come? Pick said.
Jesse nodded.
She was in love, she realized then. Completely in love with this offbeat boy whose mother had abandoned him. Pick stuck out his hand. Shake on it, he said. They shook hands, and Pick held on for a few extra seconds.
This is great, he said.
Now I don't have to go alone.
He doesn't have to go alone. She will go with him, though she hasn't the foggiest idea how she will manage to do this. But it's still nearly 2 months off, so she has time to figure it out. Maybe Kirby will take her. Or maybe the war in Vietnam will end, and Tiger will make it home in time to go with Jesse and Pick. That, of course, would be almost too good to be true. Jesse stares at the letter she's writing, then out the window at Fair Street, and she wonders what Tiger will be looking at when he reads it. I hope you're well. I think of you every day. And just in case you're wondering, nothing is the same without you. Write soon, please. Love, Messy. Peace of my heart. For the ride to the Cape in Joey Whalen's Lincoln Continental, Blair ties her poochie scarf over her hair and puts on her round black sunglasses, a fashion statement she flat-out stole from former First Lady Jackie Kennedy Onassis. Joey wants to ride with the Lincoln's top down because it's a nice day, and Blair says fine. She's just happy the vehicle is spacious enough to accommodate her girth. Joey is wearing a blue suit and a pair of Wayfarers. They cruise down Route 3 toward Cape Cod with the radio blaring. Right now, it's Janis Joplin. Blair sneaks a glance at Joey through half-closed eyes. His expression is placid and carefree as he pretends to play the drums against the steering wheel. The scene that ensued when Angus caught Blair and Joey in flagrante was so harrowing that, in retrospect, Blair can't believe she didn't go into labor right then and there. She's incredulous that Angus, who hadn't surprised Blair at home even once since they'd been married, showed up at the exact moment that Blair succumbed to her desire for Joey Whalen. Angus had gaped at Blair and Joey, and then the bouquet of flowers, which he must have bought to celebrate news of the twins, dropped to the floor.
"What the hell is going on?" he roared.
Joey and Blair had tried to pull apart, but a string from Blair's rapidly deteriorating maternity dress had caught on one of the buttons of Joey's bespoke shirt, and so there was that awkwardness to contend with, which left time for Angus to storm over to the couch and loom above them.
"How long has this been going on?"
Blair let Joey speak. There was nothing going on, he said. Joey had stopped by and Blair was upset. Joey was only trying to comfort her, and they'd gotten carried away.
"You expect me to believe that?" Angus said.
He narrowed his eyes at Joey, and Blair was puzzled over how furious Angus seemed. She hadn't seen him show that much emotion since the summer of their wedding. When they'd returned to Boston that September, and Angus went back to MIT, he had become more and more like a robot, programmed to move through life's daily routine.
"You've had the hots for my wife from the beginning."
"Well," Joey said, straightening up to stand at his full height. He was taller than Angus and broader.
"She was my girlfriend first."
Blair opened her mouth to protest, but before she could get a word out, Angus landed a punch under Joey's eye, and Joey delivered a blow to Angus's gut. Soon, the brothers were engaged in a full-on brawl, circling each other, venting old grievances. Angus resented Joey for carrying a torch for Blair and for giving Blair such a suggestive wedding gift, the silver lighter engraved with the words, "I loved you first, eternally yours, Joey." Blair brought her hands to her mouth. Angus had actually noticed the lighter. Joey said that he resented Angus for stealing Blair away without a word of apology. They grabbed each other and tumbled to the ground. Their boxing became a sort of wrestling, and Blair wanted to yell at them to stop, but she was interested in what the brothers had to say.
"You always get exactly what you want, and then some," Joey said.
because supposedly you're a genius.
What about you?
Angus spit. Coasting on your good looks, your charm, your athletic ability. People liked you better. I could never have gotten a girl like Blair if you hadn't brought her to me.
That's right, Joey said. You married a woman who's too good for you, and you're blowing it.
Joey had Angus's arms pinned over his head, and he pulled his arm back to punch him. Angus steeled himself, and Blair let a cry escape. Joey seemed to reconsider, and then he let go of Angus and got to his feet. She says you're having an affair.
Angus sat up. If that's not the pot calling the kettle black, I don't know what is.
You're lying to your pregnant wife, Joey said.
He turned to Blair. I would never do that. If you were still my girl, I would be true blue.
Angus pointed at the door. Get out!
Gladly, Joey said.
He jammed his arms into his suit jacket and bent down to look at Blair.
If you need me, just call the Parker House.
Blair waited with her head bowed as Joey left. Angus dusted himself off and disappeared into the kitchen. Blair remained on the couch, summoning the energy to get to her feet. She felt oddly glad that Angus had come home and caught her and Joey. She was a catch. She was desirable, even when pregnant. She hauled herself up and waddled to the kitchen. Angus's back was to her.
Who is Trixie? Blair asked.
And how long have you been seeing her?
Angus stared at the wall behind the kitchen sink, where Blair kept a needlepoint sampler that said, As ye sow, so shall ye reap. She nearly laughed at the irony of it.
You know what I think? Blair said. I think you've been seeing her since before we were married. I think you were talking to her on the phone on our honeymoon.
She watched Angus's shoulders tense. He looked like he was thrumming with the things he wanted to say, a confession, maybe.
And that day I came to your office? Dobbins told me you had a personal appointment.
We've been over this, Angus said. Blair tried for a haughty laugh like the one her grandmother had perfected, but it came out as a whinny.
I think you were with her. And then the other day on the phone, I heard the two of you, Angus. She said her name. You said you wanted to see her.
Angus turned around. He was holding his glasses in his hands. They were in two pieces. Joey had broken them. Blair rarely got to look directly into her husband's eyes the way she did now. His irises were brown and flecked with green. As many times as Blair had cursed his name in the past year, she remained in his thrall.
You're right, he said. I was on the phone with Trixie while we were in Bermuda, and I went to see her the day you came to my office.
Blair felt like she'd been blindsided. Even though this was what she'd suspected, it came as a fresh pain to hear him say it.
Now, I've told you the truth, and I'd like you to return the favor, please. Have you been carrying a torch for Joey all this time?
Angus laughed unhappily. I mean, I saw the two of you in the act, in our home. So obviously the answer is yes.
Blair was at a loss for words. She didn't know where to start. Angus's confession was straightforward. Yes, he'd been with Trixie. But Blair wasn't sure what had just happened with Joey. Did she have feelings for him? There was no denying there was a physical connection, but Blair thought that was because she had been so lonely. And so, so angry. Angus had stripped away Blair's personhood bit by bit. He'd made her quit her job, and now, with this pregnancy, she'd lost not only her body, but also her autonomy. Angus expected her to stay home and keep house and prepare the meals. She had faithfully done that while also serving as an incubator for their children. But Angus had given Blair nothing in return. Not his time, not his affection, not an apology, not a word of praise or thanks.
You're never home, Blair said.
The words sounded pale and limp, but that lay at the heart of the matter. She and Angus never did anything together anymore because Angus was always at work, or apparently with Trixie. Someone else was getting the best parts of him, either Trixie or his students or the U.S. government. I think you should go to Nantucket and wait out the rest of your pregnancy there, Angus said.
Blair was too proud to show him how this statement wounded her.
Nantucket, she said. How do you propose I get there? I certainly can't drive in my condition.
I'm sure Joey will take you, Angus said. Pack your things.
Joey has taken the entire day off from work, and he even brought a picnic. It's in a basket on the back seat. Near the exit for Plymouth, they pass an older gentleman driving a cherry red Mustang convertible. He honks at them and gives them the thumbs up, and Joey waves. Looking at Blair from the shoulders up, no one can tell she is pregnant. To the gentleman in the Mustang, Blair supposes, she and Joey look like any other young couple out for a ride. Joey puts a hand on Blair's knee, and she considers removing it. Is he being a sweet brother-in-law and a good guy by driving her to Hyannis? Or is he claiming her? Has she been handed off like a baton from one brother to the other? Blair doesn't have to wonder what Betty Friedan would think about this. She already knows the answer. At Blair's suggestion, they don't stop for lunch until they're up over the Sagamore Bridge and on Cape Cod. Joey drives to Craigville Beach, where there are picnic tables overlooking the water. He spreads out a red checkered tablecloth and then a lunch that was prepared by the chef at the Parker House. Cold roast beef, soft rolls, hard-boiled eggs, pickles, coleslaw, sliced strawberries, and pound cake. Blair would like to say that being thrown out of her own home by her unfaithful husband has diminished her appetite, but in fact, she's as hungry as ever. Joey watches with rapt attention as she devours a roast beef sandwich topped with sliced egg, coleslaw, and pickles, lots and lots of pickles, and then cuts a thick slice of pound cake and smothers it with berries.
My kingdom for some whipped cream, she says.
Joey holds up a finger, and Blair thinks he's about to inform her she's a spoiled brat, but instead, he races down the beach to the ice cream concession. Blair squints to see him pulling coins out of his pocket, and the next thing she knows, Joey is headed back toward her, holding a can of whipped cream. He sets it next to her plate.
Ask and you shall receive, he says. Go crazy.
This, Blair thinks, is what it feels like to be adored.
When they arrive at the ferry, Joey loads Blair's suitcase onto the luggage rack and holds her arm as he walks her to the pedestrian ramp.
I should take the ferry over with you, he says.
No, no, Blair says.
She can't imagine her mother's and grandmother's expressions if they were to see Blair arriving on Nantucket with Joey Whalen instead of Angus. Her grandmother especially would be cross and confused, and there would be a lot of explaining to do.
You've done so much already. I'll be fine.
She holds up a battered copy of The House of Mirth, which she bought for the ferry crossing. She has read it half a dozen times. It's her literary security blanket. Joey takes the book from her and inspects it.
Edith Wharton, he says. I should read this. That's how Angus won you over, isn't it?
Oh, Joey, Blair says.
She stands on her tiptoes and gives him a chaste kiss on the lips. He says,
I'll let you get settled over there, and then I'll come see you.
More than likely, I'll return to Boston next week, she says.
What she means is that she will return when Angus comes to his senses and begs her to come home.
Joey grins. That would be great.
He hugs Blair close and hard, so hard Blair fears for the babies, and then, after a final squeeze of her hand, he heads back to the car. Blair turns around to see him one more time before she steps into the dim hold of the boat. Joey is behind the wheel of the Lincoln, waving like crazy. Blair waves back, though she feels an undeniable sense of relief when he finally drives away. Everybody's talking. June 24th, 1969. Dear Tiger, you aren't going to believe this. I've been on Nantucket an entire week
and have only been to the beach once, Sunday afternoon. Just me and Mom and Dad. And Dad insisted on going all the way out to Great Point because he wanted to surf cast. The trip out there took over an hour, and we almost got stuck because Dad lets the tires down to only 15 pounds when it's supposed to be 11. Mom put a bottle of Chablis in the cooler, and once we finally got to Great Point, she started drinking. She seems to have given up all her mom duties, like she didn't offer to make sandwiches, so Dad made them, and he put mustard on my cheese sandwich, and I had to throw it to the seagulls. There was nobody out there except for fishermen and one seal that was swimming offshore. Dad said the seal meant there were fish, but Mom said the seal meant there would be sharks, so I couldn't swim. Mom didn't offer to put Coppertone on my back, and I was afraid to ask her, so I got sunburned. It was the worst beach day of my life. But that's not the part you won't believe. I'm coming to that part. Just wait. Mom promised she would take me to Cisco Beach so I could hang around with kids my own age. But after Dad left Sunday night, Mom was so sad she said she needed a day to recuperate. So we were supposed to go today, Tuesday, after my tennis lesson. My tennis lessons with Susie are going okay. Here, Jessie pauses. Today, she had adamantly signed herself in as Jessica Levin, and Exalta had ripped the pen from Jessie's hand and crossed Levin out with a bold, angry stroke. She'd said, loud enough for everyone, including the Dunscombe twins and Mrs. Winter, to hear, "Jessica, this membership has been in the Nichols family since 1905 when this club was founded. I pay the bills, not your father. Therefore, you will use my name while you use this club, or I will revoke your signing privileges altogether. Do you understand me?" To keep herself from crying, Jessie imagined Exalta crossing North Beach Street without looking both ways, as she often did, and getting hit by a car. Jessie excused herself and went to the locker room, where one of the Dunscombe twins, Helen or Heather, she couldn't tell which, disappeared into a bathroom stall. Whichever twin it was had left her Bermuda bag with a navy blue linen monogrammed cover on the counter between the sinks. Jessie eyed the Bermuda bag. The monogram was H-A-D. She wasn't sure what either twin's middle name was, but it was possible, even likely, that Helen and Heather had the same initials. While Jessie was thinking that she would never steal from the Dunscombe twins, it seemed much worse, somehow, than stealing from the club. She lifted the wooden handle and grabbed the first thing she could get her hands on, a $5 bill and a Bonnie Bell lip gloss, root beer flavor. She jammed the items into the pocket of her tennis dress. The toilet flushed. A second later, the twin emerged and smiled at Jessie. "Hi, Jessie," she said. Jessie's heart sank as she realized it was Heather, the nice twin. "Hi," she said. But Jessie decides not to burden Tiger with this story. The last thing Tiger needs to know is that while he's off being a hero, Jessie is on Nantucket turning into a hardened criminal. She doesn't intend to steal. It just happens. "But I have a long way to go when it comes to serving. I asked Susie whether anyone had ever double-faulted through an entire match, and she told me I needed an attitude adjustment." Jessie realizes she's making Susie sound mean, which she isn't. Susie is just tough in the most admirable way. She doesn't want Jessie to even consider double-faulting through an entire match. Instead, she encourages Jessie to use positive visualization. She has a few pet phrases: "Follow through with your stroke," "Charge the net." But she has also given Jessie advice that has nothing to do with tennis, such as, "Don't ever change your maiden name," and "Make your own money." "You don't want to be financially dependent on a man, do you?" Susie had asked that very morning as they collected balls off the court.
No, Jessie said.
Susie rolled a tennis ball up the side of her white sneaker, and in one swift motion with foot and racket, she flicked it up and caught it. "Tell me, Jessie, do you have any role models?"
"My brother is in Vietnam," Jessie said, "serving our country."
"Female role models," Susie said. Jessie thought about this.
The obvious answer would be her mother, although Kate didn't have a career or make her own money, and neither did Exalta. Blair used to have a job, but she quit when she married Angus. Kirby was working over on the vineyard. She'd gotten a job at a hotel, but Kirby was a free spirit and smoked marijuana besides. And although Jessie loved and idolized her sister, the term role model didn't seem to apply.
"You?" Jessie said.
"Damn straight," Susie said, and she flicked up another ball. Jessie returns to the letter. She tells herself to stay focused.
"So here's the part you won't believe. When I got home from my tennis lesson, I ran upstairs to put on my bathing suit, and guess who was sitting on my bed? Blair, that's who."
The story she told Mom and Nani is that she was lonely in Boston because Angus was always working, and she was afraid she would go into labor while she was in the apartment by herself, so she came to Nantucket. She's big, Tiger. She looks like she swallowed a Volkswagen bug. The real story... Here, Jessie stops. She promised Blair she wouldn't tell anyone the real story, but Tiger is far away, and she hasn't heard from him in weeks, so who knew if he was even getting her letters? She might as well be sticking them in bottles and tossing them into the ocean. Is that Angus is cheating on Blair with some woman named Trixie. Then, the day before yesterday, Joey Whalen came to visit. Blair told him about Angus's affair, and she started to cry. After that, Blair said, one thing led to another. You know how that can happen. As though Jessie might indeed know. And Angus walked into the apartment and caught Blair and Joey kissing. Then Angus threw Blair out. I'm happy she's here, except that Mom gave Blair my room, which means I have to go over to Little Fair and sleep in the second bedroom upstairs. I can't remember if I told you this, but Mr. Crimmins's grandson is staying in the other upstairs bedroom, and Mr. Crimmins himself is staying downstairs. It will be weird, all of us together in that tiny house, but my other option was to stay in the second twin bed in Nani's room. No, thank you. On Thursday night, Mom is taking me to the Mad Hatter to celebrate my birthday. She picked Thursday night because, as you may recall, Nani plays bridge on Thursday. Blair says she's too big to go out in public, so it will be just me and Mom. The only other person I would want to come is you. I wish you were here. Please write soon. You can write to Mom or Kirby or Blair or even Nani, but please just write so we know. Jessie nearly writes, "You're alive. You're okay. Love, Messy."
Mother's Little Helper. Sunday night, Kate drives David down to Steamboat Wharf to catch the last ferry home. And when they get there, he leans over, kisses her cheek, and says, "You're drinking too much." Kate opens her mouth to protest, but before she can say a word, David adds, "If you keep on like this, you'll turn into your mother. And neither of us wants that." He gets out of the car and joins the long line of people heading back to real life after a well-spent summer weekend. Kate waits to see if he'll wave, but the car behind her honks and she has to move along. David has made his point. He's right. She's drinking too much. The drinking started on Sunday, May 25th, the day after Tiger finished up his basic training and was deployed overseas to the central highlands of Vietnam. They went to brunch with Exalta, and Kate got so drunk that David had to carry her out of the Union Club. When she got home, she passed out in her darkened bedroom, even though it was only 3 in the afternoon. She woke up at midnight, realized it was noon in Vietnam, and started to wail. Mothers all across America were standing strong, fortified by their love of country and their hatred of communism, but Kate couldn't muster those emotions. Tiger possessed good instincts and had an abundance of street smarts. He was everything you could ask for in a soldier, and his father had been a career military man. Kate should have felt confidence and pride, but all she could think was that she might never see him again. Alcohol is the only thing that helps, pathetic as that might sound.
At home in Brookline, after David left for work and Jesse for school, Kate opened a bottle of Chablis, which she finished by lunchtime. She drank vodka and sodas all afternoon. Unlike gin, vodka had no smell. And then when David got home, she poured a scotch for each of them, which they drank while watching Walter Cronkite. Then they opened a bottle of wine with dinner, and Kate finished her day with a nightcap of either cream sherry or blackberry brandy. It wasn't quite as bad as it sounded, Kate didn't think. It was only 9 or 10 drinks per day, less than 1 an hour, although some nights she drank martinis through dinner, as she had at the Skipper on Saturday night. They'd started that dinner with champagne to celebrate David's first weekend on the island, although really this was a farce. David hated Nantucket. He would argue that he loved Nantucket. What he hated was living under Exalta's roof. The house, even with the inclusion of Little Fair, was too small for all of them, and it was a trial to live by Exalta's rules. David also disliked the way their social lives revolved around the Field and Oar Club, a place he didn't feel included or even welcome. At dinner at the Skipper, David had said, "We had a banner year at the firm, and I'm due a good bonus. Let's buy our own house here." He went on to describe a listing he'd seen for a house out in Matticat, a summer cottage that had uninterrupted views of the Atlantic. 6 bedrooms, he said, 4.5 baths, and a yard big enough for a tennis court, our own tennis court. Here, he'd reached for Kate's hand, but she lifted her champagne coupe and drained her glass. She understood David's desire for their own house, and it was tempting to dream of telling Exalta that they were moving out, but Matticat? Matticat was 6 miles to the west. It was the wilderness. How would Kate ever adjust to not being in town, not being able to walk to Charlie's Market or the club or the Skipper? And as for building their own tennis court, surely David was joking. That would be a gauche way for them to advertise the banner year David's firm had enjoyed, even worse than putting in a swimming pool. The sad fact was that Kate was a captive of her own mother, of All's Fair, and of the life she'd known for the past 48 years on Nantucket. She didn't want to move. She didn't want to change. "Mother won't live forever," Kate said. David, because he was a gentle, kind man and wouldn't argue with her even when she had summarily dismissed his hope for a new life here, smiled. "Wanna bet?" The night had deteriorated on the walk home. Kate hadn't yet told her husband that Bill Crimmins and his grandson were living in Little Fair. He knew nothing about the arrangement she'd made. She said, "I think I forgot to mention that Mother offered Little Fair to Bill Crimmins for the summer." David said, "Actually, Exalta told me you offered it to him, and his grandson." Kate nodded. She was so drunk it felt like she was moving underwater. "It was me. Are you mad?" "It's very thoughtful of you, Kate. Bill Crimmins has always done right by you, hasn't he?" Kate bowed her head and watched the toes of her pink Papagallo flats move forward, left, then right. She was so drunk it was like watching someone else's feet. Had Bill Crimmins always done right by her? Their relationship was far too complicated for that kind of blanket statement, but David, of course, knew nothing about Kate's past with the Crimmins family. She couldn't tell him about that, nor could she tell him about her agreement with Bill Crimmins this summer. David would think she was simply being kind when, really, she had traded Little Fair for Tiger's safety. Kate started to cry. David hadn't brought any letters from Tiger. Letters were oxygen, and without oxygen, Kate could not survive. She manages to make it all the way through Monday without a drink, which requires her to say no to Exalta for lunch at the club, and no to Jesse for the beach, because Kate can't endure either without wine. Instead, she shops at Charlie's for actual groceries, and she visits the farm stand on Hummock Pond Road. It's too early for corn or tomatoes, so Kate must be satisfied with radishes, lamb's lettuce, and a cantaloupe.
She makes a final stop at Amy's bakery for Portuguese bread, arriving just as they're pulling fresh loaves out of the oven. She wants to make a fine cold supper, the bread with salted butter, the lettuce and sliced radishes, and some cold poached chicken with homemade Russian dressing, and she'll break out one or two of the cheeses they brought from Savonore's. This seems like a lot for just herself, Exalta, and Jesse, so Kate ponders inviting Bill Crimmins to join them. Will this seem pushy? Kate wants to know if he has heard back from his brother-in-law, the personal friend and confidant of General Creighton W. Abrams. She assumes that Bill will come to her as soon as he has news, and she decides that having Bill Crimmins sit at the table will make her speculation unbearable. Kate watches Walter Cronkite. Then she and Jesse and Exalta eat the cold supper in the kitchen. Exalta praises the dressing and eats four pieces of bread. She drains two Hendrix and tonics packed with ice and garnished with a twist of lime. She prepares the twist herself, her only kitchen trick, and Kate volunteers to clean up in order to keep her hands occupied. At 7:30, when the dishes are done and the leftovers wrapped up and put away, the sun is still shining. It's 3 days past the solstice, and sunlight hours are long, too long. The effort required to keep from drinking has exhausted Kate. She goes up to bed. Can she do it again on Tuesday? She hears Jesse and Exalta up early for Jesse's tennis lesson, and she wants to go along, but her mother will order a mimosa, and it will be too much for Kate to resist. She lies back in bed, puts a pillow across her face to block the sun. When she wakes up again, the house is quiet. Kate climbs out of bed and goes to the window just in time to see Pick disappear the wrong way down Fair Street on his bicycle. He's wearing only a pair of yellow swim trunks and a towel around his neck. He's barefoot. Off to the beach, Kate supposes, and she yearns for the summer days when she was a child. She has yet to be properly introduced to the boy. Bill Crimmins is probably avoiding it for the obvious reasons, but it will have to happen sooner or later. Kate waits until Pick has disappeared from view. Then she goes down to the kitchen to make herself a screwdriver, extra strong. She's halfway through her second drink when she hears someone coming in the back door. Kate has been sitting in the den, watching the summer breeze stir the moving parts of Exalta's whirligigs. The Indian chief in the canoe was always Tiger's favorite. It's too early for Jesse and Exalta to be back, which means it must be Bill Crimmins. Maybe he's been to the post office. Maybe he has her answer. She abandons the screwdriver in the den. If Bill tells her what she wants to hear, what she needs to hear, she promises God that she'll quit drinking forever. When Kate enters the kitchen, she cries out in surprise. It's not Bill Crimmins she finds. It's Blair. Kate blinks, thinking her mind is playing tricks on her thanks to vodka so early in the morning, and this notion is reinforced by the fact that Blair doesn't look like Blair. She looks like a cartoon rendering of herself, like Blair if someone pumped her with air to the point of almost popping. "Sweet pea," Kate says. Blair bursts into tears. Kate makes two fresh screwdrivers and leads Blair up to her own bedroom, where she turns the air conditioning unit on high. Exalta doesn't like anyone to use the air conditioning until July, but it's already sweltering. Not only is poor Blair hysterical, she's shining with perspiration. She needs a cool room where they can talk privately. The noise of the air conditioner will mask their words should Exalta and Jesse come home. Kate worries about Blair making it up the stairs. She is so big. Blair flops on the bed and kicks her sandals off her swollen feet. Kate hands her a screwdriver. "Take a sip," she says. "The vodka will calm you, and the juice is filled with vitamin C, good for the babies." Blair accepts the glass and sucks the entire thing down. Kate takes a handkerchief from her lingerie drawer. If Blair is here, there must be very bad news indeed,
but Kate welcomes the distraction from worrying about Tiger.
What happened? Kate asks.
Blair shakes her head.
It's over with Angus.
Now, Blair, Kate says, I told you it wasn't my decision, she says. It was Angus's decision. He asked me to leave.
What?
Kate says. She considers Angus a little strange, a bit socially awkward, possibly due to his unusually high IQ, but she never imagined him to be the kind of man who would put his pregnant wife out on the street. It's barbaric, is what it is. And she's pregnant with twins. Is this because of that woman? Kate closes her eyes and bats away thoughts of Wilder and all the heartbreak she endured with him.
He admitted he was seeing her, Blair says, and then he asked me to leave.
I'm speechless, Kate says. I can't fathom Angus being so cruel. Blair casts her eyes down at her prodigious midsection.
It wasn't entirely Angus's fault.
Joey Whalen came for a visit and...
Dear God, Kate thinks, what is Blair going to say? And I kissed him, Mother. Really kissed him. And Angus walked in on us.
Blair starts weeping again.
Angus surprised me at home with flowers to celebrate the news about the twins, and I was necking with his brother.
Oh, dear, Kate thinks. She has long suspected that Blair still carries a torch for Joey, and vice versa. Surely Angus understands that you were upset about his relationship with the other woman? And surely you explained that you aren't yourself because of your condition?
He wouldn't hear any of that, Blair says. Joey made it worse by proclaiming his love for me. They had a fistfight right in front of me, and then Angus told me he thought I would be happier with Joey anyway.
What? Kate says. Nonsense!
Joey drove me to the ferry, Blair says. I think he still has feelings for me. In fact, I know he does.
How Joey Whalen feels is not our concern, Kate says. Our concern is how you feel. And you love Angus, right?
Blair hesitates, but her answer to this question doesn't matter. She married Angus for better or for worse.
Angus is the father of these babies, not Joey. Fatherhood isn't something you can just pass off to another man. Although Kate did just that, David raised her three children like they were his own.
Joey is thoughtful and dotes on me, Blair says. I'm sure he would encourage me to work after the babies are born if I wanted to.
Work after the babies are born? Kate says. You're having twins, sweet pea. They'll provide plenty of work.
I wanted whipped cream on my cake, and Joey ran and bought some from the ice cream man, Blair says.
Kate puts an arm around her daughter's shoulders.
You need to stop talking nonsense. You're married to Angus. You'll remain married to Angus, and you will stay home and raise those children just like I stayed home to raise you. Motherhood is a sacrifice. That's what makes it so rewarding.
But Angus will come around in a few days, Kate says, a week at the most, and then we'll ship you home. While Blair sobs into the handkerchief, Kate considers the logistics of having Blair here for even a week. They'll need to call the cottage hospital that very afternoon to make certain there's a doctor who can deliver the babies in case of emergency. And where will Blair sleep? Kate can't put her in Little Fair with the Crimminses. She'll have to take Jessie's room, and Jessie can go over to Little Fair. That's not optimal, but it's only a week. Jessie will survive. Poor Jessie. Kate promised her a beach day, and that's now out the window. Plus, she's being kicked out of her bedroom. Kate downs her screwdriver, and despite the chaos, a calm spreads through her. She'll take Jessie out to dinner Thursday night while Exalta is at bridge, and she'll start to give Jessie a little more freedom. That's what all kids want these days, Kate thinks. Freedom. Magic Carpet Ride. Reprise. Kirby spends her first days off being a third wheel with Patty and Luke, who have very quickly become a couple. Luke Winslow is a rising senior at Columbia University. He's majoring in business, and when he graduates,
He will head straight to Wall Street, he says, to work for his father's investment firm, Drexel Harriman Ripley. In fact, Luke's parents own the house on the vineyard where Patty's brother Tommy and his roommate Eugene live. Kirby expects something halfway between a flop house and a fraternity house, but when they pull into the driveway, after a beautiful, hilly, bucolic ride up island to Chilmark, Kirby sees a compound that overlooks Nashiquitza Pond. There are two ranch houses sided with cedar shingles, like most of the homes on Nantucket. The slightly smaller one is where the boys live. Luke's parents live in the other, though they come to the vineyard only on the weekends. The house the boys live in blows Kirby's mind. Sliding screen doors open onto one long room with stark white walls and white beams. The furniture is modern and curvy. Against one wall is a lipstick red sofa that looks like a woman lying on her side. It's flanked by two shell chairs, one turquoise, one electric lime green. There are enormous canvases on the walls, all female nudes, modern, reminiscent of Matisse and Chagall. At one end of the room is a minimalist kitchen, three swivel bar stools at a white marble countertop, on top of which is a wide wooden bowl filled with plums and Bing cherries, open shelves stacked with rustic ceramic dishes. At the other end of the house are two bedrooms, one with two double beds for Tommy and Eugene, the other with one king bed for Luke, all sheathed in crisp white linens. The bedrooms are connected by a white subway-tiled bathroom that has a floor paved with slate-blue river stones. Okay, Kirby thinks. This is absolutely the grooviest house she has ever seen. There's a chandelier in the living room that looks like an origami fish. It's made of rice paper, Luke says. Who did all the paintings? Kirby asks. The nude women are all voluptuous, with long Botticelli-like hair. My mother, Luke says. Elsa Winslow? He says the name like Kirby might have heard of her. She has taken one art history course at Simmons, which is how she knows Matisse and Chagall. Kirby wonders if Elsa Winslow is famous. Maybe she has a cult following, like Andy Warhol. She's an amazing painter, Kirby says. Yeah, Luke says, and she knows it. Kirby looks at Luke with new eyes. She had originally thought him just a regular guy. Privileged, obviously, given the painstakingly restored Willis Jeep, but not so different from guys in Brookline. Now that Kirby is standing in this super-hip beach bungalow, she's intrigued. Kirby imagines his parents, a Midtown financial power broker and a Greenwich Village bohemian artist, with envy. They aren't hung up on budgets or rules like Kirby's parents are. They have given Luke his own house, essentially, to live in with his friends. Kirby peers into the bedrooms. Honestly, I thought with three guys living here, this place would be a mess. I can't believe how tidy it is. We have a housekeeper, Luke says. Martine. She lives up at the other house. Luke grabs Patty and starts tickling her, and Patty shrieks, and the two of them fall over onto the red couch. When they start kissing, Kirby nearly asks them to quit it, but she doesn't want to be a wet blanket. She wanders over to the kitchen counter and considers the bowl of fruit. The plums and the cherries are nearly the same color, but not quite. Deep purple and glorious purplish red. And Kirby realizes that even the fruit is meant to be art. She plucks a cherry out of the bowl. It's fat and juicy looking, and Kirby can't resist popping it into her mouth. Her diet since arriving on this island has consisted of breakfast porridge, fried clams from Giordano's, and stale donuts at the inn. The cherry is sweeter than any she has ever tasted. She sucks on the pit until it's clean, then discreetly spits it out in her hand. Behind her on the sofa, she hears wet tongue noises and heavy breathing. She tries not to think about Scotty Turbo. No one would ever call Kirby a prude, but she doesn't want to stand here while Luke and Patty fool around. Kirby steps out the sliding door. In her peripheral vision, she catches sight of Luke leading Patty back to his bedroom. Kirby hears the door shut.
fine. She's not sure why she feels embarrassed. They should feel embarrassed. Patty might not know any better, but Luke has clearly been raised with some social graces. And yet, he's a boy, and boys want what they want when they want it. Kirby has learned this the hard way. To distract herself, she takes in the view over the pond. It's nothing short of spectacular. Kirby halfway hopes that Patty marries Luke and inherits this compound from the banker father and artist mother so that Kirby can continue to visit this spot for the rest of her life. She sits on the deck with her face to the sun, and a little while later, Patty and Luke appear. Patty looks flushed, Luke triumphant.
"Shall we go to the beach?" Luke asks.
Because Luke lives in Chilmark, he has access to Lucy Vincent Beach. "It's the most exclusive of all the vineyard beaches," he explains. "You guys are lucky you met me." He grins, so Kirby can't hate him, though she's starting to, a little. Once she steps onto Lucy Vincent, however, she agrees. They are lucky. They, meaning Patty, they met Luke Winslow. The beach is wide and golden and backed by stark dramatic cliffs. It's far, far more beautiful than Inkwell, not even in the same class, really, which makes Kirby indignant. She wonders if this is an example of institutional racism. But then she tells herself to relax. Inkwell is a town beach, and this is an up-island beach, windswept and wild. Kirby quickly sees that, up ahead, there's a gentleman walking toward the water who is nude. As in, completely nude. She sees his penis hanging heavy between his legs. Kirby scans the beach and realizes that everyone on the beach is nude. They're reading in chairs. They're sleeping face down, bippies to the sky. They're walking hand in hand, having conversations. All completely nude. Kirby tries not to let her surprise show on her face. It's 1969. Nudity is no big deal, she knows, but, my God, it's more disconcerting being a clothed person on a nude beach than it is being a white person on a Negro beach. Will Kirby be expected to strip down? She casts a sidelong glance at Patty. Her face is bright red, but whether with embarrassment or the sun, Kirby can't say. She's a good Catholic. This must come as a shock. Luke finds a wide-open space and plops down their styrofoam cooler, which is filled with schlitz and chicken sandwiches prepared by Martine, the French maid. Kirby caught a glimpse of her in her black uniform, complete with a white apron and frilled cap. He sets up the chairs, and Kirby waits, wondering what will happen next. Patty pulls off her gauzy black cover-up to reveal a conservative black tank suit.
"We're at Lucy Vincent," Luke says, "everything off."
Patty shakes her head.
"Patricia,"
Luke says. "She doesn't want to," Kirby says, "and I don't want to either." Kirby pulls off her denim cutoffs and peasant blouse, but decides her bikini is staying on. Patty, however, peels away her black suit until she is standing before them in the splendid altogether. Her flesh is plentiful. She looks like a woman in a Rubens painting. She looks, Kirby thinks, like a woman in an Elsa Winslow painting, with her round breasts and ruddy nipples, her generous thighs, and the curve of her belly that slopes down to her dark pubic hair. Kirby recognizes the romanticism before her. Luke has found his mother's art personified in Patty. But then Kirby notices that Patty is trembling. Kirby sees a pronounced red mark on Patty's haunches, a handprint. Luke shucks off his suit while facing away from Kirby, so all she can see is his white behind. She busies herself by laying out her towel. She lies on her stomach and unties the string of her bikini top, but that's as far as she'll go. She cranes her neck to see Luke leading Patty to the water, both of them naked as jaybirds. Kirby sets her head down on her folded arms. What she told her parents is proving to be true. Spending the summer on the vineyard is quite educational.
A few days later, the temperature soars to the mid-80s with 100% humidity. There's a breeze off the water early in the week, but by Friday, the sky is heavy, gray, and overcast. The air is hot and soupy. Naturally, the fan in Kirby's room picks this week to die a dramatic death. It stops spinning for no apparent reason, and when Kirby goes over to wiggle the plug, there is a sudden flash of electrical sparks, followed by an acrid smell. She can't live without a fan. Heat rises, and she's in the attic, and although there's a window, without the fan, the air is still. She corners Evan, Miss O'Rourke's nephew, who says he will go out and get her a new fan. It would be his pleasure. That afternoon, there's a knock on Kirby's bedroom door. She's lying in bed listening to Aretha Franklin's Lady Soul, which is the album she bought for her rainy day-slash-Sunday mood. If it's Michaela complaining about the volume, Kirby decides, she'll apologize profusely and then, once Michaela is back downstairs, put on her angry mood album, Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland, at top volume. It might be Patty at the door. Luke picked Patty up earlier for a lobster roll date in Menemsha, and Patty asked Kirby to go, but Kirby declined. Patty, not Kirby, is Luke's girlfriend, and Kirby's beginning to find it strange that Patty wants her to join them every time they're together. Kirby wondered briefly if Patty was afraid of Luke. She had asked Patty about the red mark on her thigh. "Did he hit you while you two were in the bedroom?" she asked. "Did he, I don't know, spank you?" Patty laughed uncomfortably. "It's a game," she said. "Role-playing." "Role-playing?" Kirby said. "I'm an actress," Patty said. When Kirby opens the door, she finds Barb standing before her. Kirby is surprised. She would have thought the hot, mouse-infested attic was the last place Barb would ever show her face. "You have a visitor," Barb says. "I do," Kirby says. She assumes that Evan has arrived with the fan, and not a moment too soon. She throws on a polka-dot mini-dress and ties a bandana around her hair. As she hurries down the stairs, she wonders what Evan might expect as a thank you. Barb waits at the top of the second-floor stairs along with Miranda and Maureen. Michaela is blessedly absent, and Kirby figures they must be really bored if they're that interested in seeing Evan in his brown polyester pants and Sunday-best shoes. But when Kirby gets to the front door, she understands. It's not Evan. It's Darren Fraser. Kirby knows that for these girls, having a gentleman caller is a big deal. Having a Negro gentleman caller is, she suspects, brand new territory for them. Kirby's heart fills like a hot air balloon. "Hey, you," she says.
"Day off," he says. "I thought you might want to ride the carousel."
"I'd love it," Kirby says. She turns to wave at the girls who are loitering at the top of the stairs like they're watching Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
"See ya, ladies."
As rotten, terrible luck would have it, they bump into Evan outside on the sidewalk. He's holding a huge rectangular box that Kirby can see is an air conditioning unit. "Is that for my room?" she asks hopefully.
"It's supposed to be."
Evan grunts and drops the box onto the top step with a thud. Air conditioning is more than Kirby could have hoped for. "Evan, I can't thank you enough. You have no idea what it's like up there. I've been stewing in my own juices." She chastises herself for using that gross phrase in front of two gentlemen. Her mother would be appalled. "I'm very grateful." Evan pulls a handkerchief out of his pants pocket and mops his brow.
"I don't know how I'm going to get it all the way up to the attic."
"I've got it, man," Darren says, stepping up.
"Darren?"
Evan says, blinking behind his square glasses.
"Darren Fraser?
Where did you come from?"
Darren has, of course, been standing there all along. How did Evan not notice him? Was Ralph Ellison right? Were Negro men invisible to white people? It had seemed like hyperbole when Kirby read the book for her English class, but now that she's watching a real-life social interaction, she's not so sure. Darren lifts the box with ease.
Fresh arms, he says, and Kirby thinks of how other guys might have flaunted their superior strength and stamina, but Darren tries to downplay it.
We're going to the attic?
The attic, Kirby confirms. Evan follows close on Darren's heels up the two flights of stairs and, realizing he's been shown up, offers to take the box back twice.
I've got it, Darren says.
He's not huffing or sweating, and his biceps pop in a way that is undeniably attractive. Kirby brings up the rear, which means Evan can't look up her dress. Darren is proving to be a hero for so many reasons. Kirby opens the door to the attic, and the hot, stale air nearly knocks her over. It's like having a damp mohair blanket thrown over her head. It's suffocating.
Right on, Darren says. I now understand the importance of this mission.
You've been living up here?
I had a fan, but it broke, Kirby says.
She scans the room for any embarrassing personal items. If she'd known she would be having guests, and if she'd known one of those guests would be Darren, she might have staged the room a little better, hidden the box of Kotex, for example, and maybe draped a bikini top over the back of her chair. Maybe set her paperback copy of Invisible Man on her nightstand. Earlier, she'd pulled a copy of Emily Post off the bookshelves at the hotel, thinking it would help her with her job, and she hopes Darren doesn't notice it splayed open on her bed. It seems hopelessly square. Darren sets down the box, removes the air conditioner from the styrofoam packing, then surveys the sole window.
Should fit, he says.
He looks to Evan, who shrugs, and Kirby's hopes sink because she's certain Evan didn't bother to measure the window, so her dream of air conditioning may be short-lived. Darren sets the unit in the window. There are a couple of inches on each side. Darren turns to Kirby. Do you have a couple of books? This is Kirby's chance. She rummages through an old attaché case of her father's that she uses for her schoolwork. She brought 6 books for recreational reading, but hasn't yet cracked one. She picks 2 that she thinks will make her seem erudite and well-read. The Prime of Miss Jean Brody by Muriel Spark and The Ginger Man by J.P. Donlevy. Darren accepts them and holds up The Ginger Man.
Loved this one, he says. I loved it so much it seems a shame to use it for this purpose. But this is just temporary. I have a couple of 2x4s in my garage that I can cut down to fit in the gaps.
Kirby glances at Evan to see if he is hearing all this. Darren reads literature, and he can cut down some 2x4s to fit in the gaps of the window that Evan neglected to measure. Evan is standing back with his arms locked across his chest, glaring down at Darren. He isn't even pretending to help anymore. Kirby is annoyed. But a second later, the air conditioner is installed. Darren plugs it in and turns it on. Kirby stands before the blast of deliciously cold air and closes her eyes. It's heavenly, she says.
You're welcome, Evan says. Please don't make a big deal about it because I can't afford air conditioning for anyone else. It's just that it does get really hot up here.
Thank you, Kirby says.
Thank you, Kirby says to Darren once they're back down on the street. Evan bought you an air conditioner because he likes you, Darren says. It's a 26-pound love letter.
Please stop, Kirby says. I feel like I have to apologize for Evan. He just stood back and let you do all the work.
Darren shrugs. I offered. I wanted to impress you.
Kirby grins. You did?
He reaches for her hand, and it feels like the most natural thing in the world.
Because the day is overcast and people aren't at the beach, the line at the Flying Horses Carousel is long. Darren buys their tickets and a box of popcorn for them to share while they watch people of all ages ride around on the antique horses, everyone grabbing silver ring after silver ring from the dispenser and stacking them on their animals' ears. The last ring, Darren explains, is brass, and grabbing the brass ring wins you an extra ride. It's a lot of hoopla for 40 cents, he says, but it makes the ride more fun.
Have you ever gotten the brass ring? Kirby asks.
Never once, Darren says. My mother used to say it was because I was so lucky in the rest of my life.
Kirby says, I don't think your mother likes me. She gave me a dirty look at the beach the other day.
Darren throws away the empty popcorn box and reclaims Kirby's hand. Her heart not only sings, it hits a soprano's high note.
My mother is protective, he says. Trust me, it's not you.
Trust me, it is me, Kirby thinks. Have you ever had a serious girlfriend? She asks.
One, Darren says, my freshman year. Her name was Amanda.
Amanda. She sounds white, but Kirby is afraid to ask. She finds she's jealous of Amanda, which is ridiculous.
Did your mother like Amanda? Kirby asks.
Hated her, Darren says, and he laughs. How about you? Have you had a serious boyfriend?
Officer Scotty Turbo, she thinks. But there's no way she's going to tell that story. However, she finds she can't discount it either.
One, she says, he was older. A policeman.
A policeman? Darren says. He whistles. Damn, that's tough to compete with. I'm jealous.
Kirby squeezes his hand. You shouldn't be, she says. It's over, and I mean over.
When it's finally their turn to ride the carousel, they pick horses next to each other, Darren on the inside and Kirby on the outside. The carousel starts to spin, and Kirby raises her hands over her head. She has never felt this happy. Neither of them gets the brass ring. It goes to a little girl with custard-colored curls who looks like Buffy from Family Affair. But even so, Kirby gets off the carousel, feeling like she's lucky in every part of her life. Darren walks Kirby back to the house on Narragansett Avenue and says,
I'll be by tomorrow with those 2x4s. And hey, why don't you come to my house for dinner on Sunday night? Sundays we always do steamers.
Are you sure? Kirby says. She loves steamer clams. On Nantucket, she and Tiger harvested their own clams using rakes that had belonged to their grandfather. No matter how thoroughly they rinsed them, they always ended up with sand in the bowl, and that was what made them authentic.
Sure, I'm sure, Darren says. Come at 5. That'll give us plenty of time to hang out before you have to go to work. You can get to know my mom a little better, and my dad is way easier than my mom.
His mom is the real judge, Kirby thinks.
Okay, she says. I'll see you Sunday.
Darren leans over and kisses Kirby gently on the lips. Before she can register how good it feels, he's walking away with a wave.